dozers so that they would not be able to do their work and knock down large ancient trees as if they were toothpicks. So he created awareness, and he created a stamina, and he created an energy and a focus on saving the area of ancient forest in the state of Akati. It was not popular, and he was murdered by cattle ranchers.
He was murdered in 1988, I believe.
He was murdered December 22nd in the evening, 1988, in his home.
15 years ago to the day. Tell us a little bit more about how they took action. They would stand in front of the bulldozers. Explain that a little bit.
Well, impachi is when the families and their young children, who were very frightened and nervous about doing this in the first place, but they had to take the chance, and they would stand in front of large trees as bulldozers were coming forward to knock them down. And, of course, the men who were driving the bulldozers were hired hands by the ranchers. And in some cases, they knew these people very well, and they were not going to run them over. So they were successful. The people, the common people, were successful.
What did Chico Mendez realize? I know that nobody really had a chance to get to know him well, but he certainly had a vision and an understanding of the implications well beyond his own situation there in Brazil.
Well, he learned that. He probably didn't consider himself an environmentalist early on until he realized the bigger picture himself. Remember, he was a humble man. He couldn't even afford to buy a pack of cigarettes. But he worked day and night trying to teach the people in the forest and outside of the forest about the way the forest worked and how important it was and how terrible it was going to be for everyone in that area and beyond without the forest. Environmentalists would talk to him, and then, of course, there was Senator Kasten of North Dakota, I think, who got very interested in Chico Mendez, and even Al Gore used him in his first book before he became vice president. I think that he really, once he realized the bigger picture and how everything was connected, not only ecologically, but financially, he had to be a speaker for his geography. He had to be a speaker for his landscape, for his people, for his livelihood, and for all setting ghettos of the world.
You said he was a humble man, couldn't even afford a pack of cigarettes. How did he become a local activist? How did he get so deeply involved in this kind of resistance?
Well, when he saw several of his friends being murdered, who were activists before he was, they say there were over 50 or 100 other Chico Mendez before this Chico Mendez was murdered. And he was very close with his compañeros, who were fellow rubber tappers, trying to stop the violence against rubber tappers by cattle ranchers and trying to stop the destruction of the forest. It was not just forest destruction going on, but it was murders of hired hands. It was complete abuse and discrimination of rubber tappers and hired hands on ranches and things like this. And he wanted to stop all violence. He used peace as his tool. His way was to get involved. He was not going to witness any more murders of his close friends and compañeros. The only way he could stop that was to get involved and spread the word and actually even maybe not befriend the ranchers, but try to create a communication between ranchers and setting ghettos. And he was successful for a while.
When he was killed in 1988, was there any outcry? Was there an attempt to investigate, to prosecute?
Well, of course, the murderers, Darli Alves da Silva and Darcy, the son of Darli, supposedly the killers who pulled the trigger outside the house in the dark, of course, they were arrested, but they escaped. They are in prison now, but according to the widow of Chico, Ilzamar tells me that the father gets to go home on during the week and has to come back for the weekends, and it's not really much of a prison sentence at this point. She did make a cry that when he was recaptured, that he would not be put in prison in the state of Acre, but in the state of Brasilia, which is, of course, the capital of Brazil. And the reason for that is because in the state of Acre, he had too many friends that were cattle ranchers, and they're the people who have the money and own the land. There are about 12 families that own Acre, and they are the ones who decide what happens to the landscape, regardless of what happens to the people.
We're speaking to painter and writer Art Jacqueline Bishop, and we're remembering the life and times of Chico Mendes. He was murdered in Brazil in 1988, exactly 15 years to the day. And Jacqueline Bishop painted a portrait of him every year and collected a wealth of information about his life for over 10 years. Jacqueline Bishop, what is the situation now? If Chico Mendes came back, would he be relieved? People picked up his work, or was he killed and then the people who had much less respect for the environment were essentially given their way?
I think that he would be pleased by some things, and I think that he would be crying blood tears, as he is in my painting, about other issues. After he died, there were many, many groups that organized in the name of Chico Mendes, and some of them were making money on his name. Not one organization attempted to get permission from the widow, who is the president of the Fundação Chico Mendes, which is the Chico Mendes Foundation. No one gave her any attention, and some people felt that she was not receptive enough to his philosophies, ideas, and work at the time of his life. But some people forget that she was a young mother with two of his children, very frightened for their lives and his life, was receiving annuncios, which is the very popular Brazilian death threat, and she didn't know what was going to happen, and she wanted a better life. And he didn't have much time to give to the family in some cases because he was working on this day and night. And towards the end, when he was receiving the annuncios, the last one, I think, was December 15th on his birthday. And then he was murdered on the 22nd, buried on Christmas Day. There are a lot of oportunistas, many people who were opportunists with his name and trying to make money, whether it be on a T-shirt or this or that. But where did that money go? What are they using it for? Are they helping the Chico Mendes Foundation? Are they helping the rubber tappers? Are they helping the landscape? Are they getting the word out about the environment locally in Brazil, nationally in Brazil, and globally? I mean, what is going on in the name of Chico Mendes? It reminds me of something that goes in the name of Jesus Christ. So many people make money off of his name, too.
I know that you've had an opportunity to get to know his widow a little bit. How is she doing these days, and is she still involved?
She is still the president of the Fundação Chico Mendes, but there is less money. Their home has been turned into a museum for tourists, so there is tourism in Chapari for the first time. The last few years, each time I go back, I see a few more people there from different places around South America. She's still very active in trying to raise money for the Seringueiros that remained true to her. But after Chico died, many of the Seringueiros organizations split up and everybody went in their own ways, and some of them actually even started to help cut down trees.
You said that he was at one point a partner with the current leader of Brazil, Lula. What was that like, and has Lula remembered his former partner?
The Wall Street Journal had an incredible article last month about how Lula and the government decided that it was time to develop Amazonia, which is very sad since Lula and Chico were companheiros in the PT, in the Workers' Party. Both came from similar backgrounds, and so I don't really know what any of this means, but recently the Comitê de Chico Mendes, which was a committee that was formed right after Chico was murdered, so they have been pushing for the reopening of the Chico Mendes case. And when I was there this summer, I got word from journalists and artist friends of mine that all of the ranchers' mouths were shut and they were not talking because they were concerned, because Ilzamar always said that it was a conspiracy. It was not just those two cattle ranchers, that it was a conspiracy of the wealthy families in Acre, of the ranchers, and other people said it was not. So apparently the Comitê de Chico Mendes want the case reopened, and Marina da Silva, who is the Minister of Environment, is pushing for the reopening of the Chico Mendes case, and Lula is for it as well. I hope that there is a reopening of it, because the truth must be known and justice must be served.
Well, I know, Jacqueline Bishop, that you and a small group of people will be remembering with a candlelight vigil tonight. Before you go, I do want to ask you about your amazing 10-year study. As I said earlier, you began painting a portrait every year after his death. Tell us about your study and your work and your book.
First of all, the book and the paintings of Chico are really not what I do. That was something that is related to my work. I am a painter, and I deal with the issue of seduction and the sublime or the beauty of landscape. And I do study orchids, and I usually spend about a month living in a tent in the Amazon, far away outside of Manaus, with a partner that I've been traveling with for 12 years. So I live in a tent, and I study the birds, and I study the orchids, and they figure into the paintings. I don't really consider myself a landscape painter, but I do paint elements of the landscape. And I don't really even consider myself a political artist, although I find poetry in politics. And I teach a class called Art and Environment at Loyola University, studying more of a philosophy class about the environment, going from the 60s to the present. My paintings themselves, I do show in exhibitions, and there's different galleries that represent me.
I'm even more interested now, given what you've described. What got you to devote such time, a decade, to this situation? Why were you motivated to step a little bit away from your work to do this?
I got into grad school in the early 80s at Tulane, and I started using a lot of bird imagery, and I had to do a lot of research on birds, and in the process of doing this research, I found out that many of the birds that I had painted were extinct. And I thought that was a very strong way to describe anything. Extinct, that means it's over. And about that time, I learned about Chico Mendes, and then after that, in 88, he was murdered. And that was such a blow to my psyche and to my concentration in my work that I turned my attention to Chico Mendes. I equated him with the birds who I found extinct, because I realized that no one else could do the work that he did. So he was essentially extinct. And it was an injustice that people were not paying attention to. And he was not well known in the United States. And that's what happened. And that's when I decided I learned Portuguese and started traveling to Brazil every year.
Jacqueline Bishop, a terrific work, very important story. We thank you for taking this time out to talk to us about Chico Mendes, who was assassinated in 1988, 15 years ago to the day, and we wish you well on your vigil this evening. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
We will present the Block Report tomorrow, and that does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein, with associate producers Nora Barra-Friedman and Solange Echeverria, roving producer Miguel Molina, and contributing producer Robert Knight. Our technical director is Mary Bishop. To comment on today's program, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. For a taped copy of this broadcast, please call 510-848-6767, extension 625. An archive of our recent shows can be heard on the web at www.flashpoints.net. Many thanks to our web team of Kevin Purcell and Brad Smith, and thank you for listening.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Coming up next, Queer Voices.
First you listen, then you fall in love. You have your favorite programs that you listen to each and every week. And finally, you do the right thing by calling in that pledge of support to KPFT. You feel great, but guess what? Your job, it's not done just yet. You still need to fulfill your promise to KPFT by sending that pledge payment today. And when you do, you take that often forgotten last step. Don't wait any longer. KPFT depends on you.
Imagine yourself picking freshly grown fruit right off the tree in your own yard. Many varieties of fruit grow easily in the Houston climate, including apples, oranges, peaches, pears, plums, persimmons, and many more. You can purchase your fruit tree at the annual Urban Harvest Fruit Tree Sale on Saturday, January 17th. Urban Harvest is a nonprofit organization that supports community gardening in Houston. We are located at 1900 Kane Street, just west of downtown. The sale is open from 9 a.m. until 2 p.m. For more information, call Urban Harvest 713-880-5540 or visit us online at www.urbanharvest.org. Thanks to KPFT Houston for this public service announcement.
Remember the good old days of radio when you could kick back, tune into your favorite radio station, and hear some great rock and roll, blues, soul, funk, and more? Well, those days are back at Joe's Roadhouse, 3 to 6 Saturday afternoons on KPFT 90.1 Houston. Get the funk out and tune into Joe's Roadhouse. We'll get your groove on.
FM. This is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. It's 70 degrees here in Houston, and tonight on our show,
we will have Davina Katulski, PhD, who is part of the California Marriage Initiative. She'll be talking to us about her new book, Why You Should Give a Damn About Gay Marriage. And as we know, Jack, gay marriage has been in the news quite a bit lately, so it will be interesting to see Davina Katulski's take on this.
Yes, there is a poll in the New York Times this past Sunday, which I'm sure we'll discuss. In the second hour, we're going to be doing this part two of the Christmas special done by JD, which has a lot of unusual, neat, and gay-related Christmas-type holiday music, of course. Also, we will be doing stuff from This Way Out, including news wrap and some other features, including audio file, and all that is coming up on this edition, this Christmas holiday edition of Queer Voices. And just to remind you, in next week, we're going to be doing the year-end review. So all that's coming up, but first, we go to London and listen to the live newscast from the BBC.
BBC News with Jackie Leonard. The US-appointed Iraqi interim governing council has received promises from Italy and Russia to help with the reconstruction of Iraq. Italy has promised the visiting foreign minister of the governing council, Hishia Zebari, that it will train Iraqi diplomats, magistrates, and high-level civilian officials. The Italians have also promised to maintain and even increase their 3,000-strong military contingent in Iraq. David Woolley reports from Rome.
Before meeting his Italian counterpart, the foreign minister of Iraq's new interim administration gave the green light to Italian businessmen who are hoping to secure contracts in rebuilding his war-torn country. So far, nearly 350 Italian companies have expressed interest in tendering for contracts in Iraq, according to the Italian Employers Association, Confindustria. And last week, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi agreed to forgo repayment of a substantial part of Iraq's $1.7 billion debt to Italy.
Earlier, a delegation from the U.S.-appointed Iraqi administration in Iraq secured a deal in Moscow in which Russia agreed to write off two-thirds of Iraq's $8 billion debt to Moscow in return for Russian participation in exploiting Iraqi oil fields. The deal must now be finalized at the Paris Club of Donors, which oversees Iraq's foreign debt repayments. The Egyptian foreign minister, Ahmed Maher, has arrived home following treatment at a Jerusalem hospital after he was jostled and hit with shoes by angry Palestinians at the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Paul Wood reports from Cairo.
The Egyptian foreign minister has been seen smiling and back on his feet, but he was clearly shaken by this attack at the Haram al-Sharif. As he was jostled and hit with shoes, a traditional Arab insult, members of the crowd could clearly be heard shouting traitor and collaborator. Whoever shakes hands with killers isn't welcome here, he was told. He'd just come from a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, but this assault on Mr. Maher is also a sign of the extreme tensions within the Palestinian camp and whether there should be a ceasefire by militant groups.
You're listening to the news from the BBC in London. The founder of Italy's leading food group, Parmalat, Callisto Tanzi, is under investigation for fraud after the company admitted a $5 billion hole in its finances. Mr. Tanzi resigned last week as head of the company that employs more than 35,000 people in 30 countries. The BBC business reporter says the case is being described as Europe's Enron. The U.S. energy trading company toppled in 2001 by an accounting scandal that rocked the corporate world. A new study has concluded that emissions of soot could be having a significant impact on global warming. Scientists from a NASA research institute warn that tiny particles settling on snow and ice could be responsible for as much as a quarter of the global warming over the past 100 years. Our environment correspondent Tim Hirsch reports.
A fresh covering of snow gives the impression of pristine purity, but in fact it contains tiny particles of soot from the burning of wood, coal and diesel fuel around the world. This makes the snow absorb sunlight instead of reflecting it. The scientists from a NASA research institute reporting in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences believe this could be having a much greater impact on climate change than previously thought. They estimate that it could account for up to a quarter of the global warming observed in the past century.
Extra security measures have been put into effect across the United States after Sunday's announcement that the level of security was being raised in response to intelligence suggesting a major terrorist attack might be planned. Some of the tightest security is at Reagan National Airport in Washington, whose flight paths are close to the White House and the U.S. Congress. Passengers, in addition to careful screening, are not allowed to stand up on board aircraft for the first half hour of the flight. The deadline is approaching for families of those killed and injured in the September the 11th attacks in the United States to claim compensation from a special U.S. government fund. The fund has so far resolved nearly 1,800 claims. The average award to the family of someone who died is $1,800,000. The fund offers compensation to relatives as long as they renounce all rights to sue the airlines whose planes were used in the attacks. At least two people have been killed in an earthquake in central and southern California. A third person is missing. Officials say a number of buildings collapsed and power supplies were cut as the quake shook an area stretching from Los Angeles to San Francisco. The United States Geological Survey said the earthquake measured 6.5 on the Richter scale. BBC News.
Whether you're celebrating the winter solstice, Hanukkah, Christmas or Kwanzaa, KPFT and the staff wish you the happiest of holiday seasons.
This is Queer Voices.
No, we won't.
Good evening, this is Jack Falinski.
And I'm Joan Devlin.
And J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
It's our holiday show, and we're opening present. Glenn's the only one.
Glenn's all presents.
Usually Glenn's the one that forgets about it, but Glenn, I guess he thought about it in July.
Yeah, I did my Christmas shopping in July, literally.
Christmas in July, July 25th.
Yep.
So, we didn't buy presents for each other, but Joan bought a cake, and we, of course, are not decorating our tree because we don't have one.
Right.
We're only squatters here on Monday.
We should have told them there was a tree.
Our beautiful Christmas tree.
Radio, yes, you'll believe anything. Well, but what we are doing for Christmas, and JD did it in our second hour, we're doing part two of the Christmas. Why don't you explain it?
It's the Queer Christmas Special, all gay-related songs, and it's going to start out with, I'm giving it away already, a Katy Lang Christmas song that's never been on one of her CDs, and the show will end with a wild finish, so please stick around for that.
And in the first hour, after News Wrap, we're going to be talking to
Davina Katulski, PhD. She is a member of the California Marriage Initiative and has just written a book called Why You Should Give a Damn About Gay Marriage. She's going to be talking to us about her book and also about why the gay marriage issue is very important to our community.
And, of course, segments from This Way Out. But before we get into News Wrap, I do want to talk a little bit about The Event, which is a movie that's playing at Greenway, and it's in its last week, and it's only played, like, at the 9:50 show, so it's the last show of the night. It is a tough movie to see, but it's done very well. Olivia Dukakis plays the mother of a gentleman who is dying from AIDS and who decides to have a party, you know, sort of say goodbye to all the friends, and then there's, you know, I won't give away the ending, but... You know, it's not over, and we're still dealing with this issue. and people are still getting sick, and this sort of brings it all home. There was another movie done a few years ago called It's My Party.
Only everybody was pretty then, though.
Yes.
Yeah, it was had Gregory Harrison. I remember that movie. Margaret Cho was in it.
And this one is a much more serious, also, you know, funny and things like that. But it's a great movie if you get a chance to see it. I'm sure it'll be out in video sometime in the future. So let's go to NewsWrap.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending December 20th, 2003.
This is the first class action decision awarding compensation to gays and lesbians for discrimination anywhere in the world.
That's what attorney Douglas Elliott told reporters about an Ontario Superior Court decision this week, awarding survivor benefits from the taxpayer-funded Canada Pension Plan to gays and lesbians whose same-gender partners have died. It's estimated that 1,500 to 2,000 potential beneficiaries could receive a total award of about $400 million Canadian dollars. It's not yet known if the Canadian government will decide to appeal. Canada's Parliament had opened the CPP survivor benefits to same-gender survivors when it adopted the Omnibus Bill C-23 of 2000, which extended all the rights and responsibilities of legal marriage to domestic partners, regardless of gender. But that law is retroactive only to 1998, denying benefits to survivors whose partners died earlier. The National Class Action lawsuit argued that the cutoff was discriminatory and that the benefits should extend back at least to the 1985 establishment of Canada's primary guarantee of equality, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. As taxpayers, gays and lesbians had always been required to contribute to the CPP at the same level as heterosexuals.
76-year-old lead plaintiff and veteran activist for gay and lesbian civil rights, George Hislop, whose partner of 28 years, Ronnie Shearer, died in 1986, pointed out that the contested years included the decade in which the largest number of Canadian gay men had died of AIDS. A lesbian and three other gay men also represented survivors in court, while some 400 others so far have registered to join the lawsuit. Nova Scotia plaintiff Albert McNutt, whose partner Gary Pask died in 1993, expressed their shared sentiment about exclusion from the benefits when he told reporters,
"I really felt as though our relationship didn't count. We didn't count as a couple. To have your relationship not thought of in a legitimate way and demeaned in that sense, it really tore me apart."
Ontario Superior Court Justice Ellen MacDonald agreed that the government's time limit on survivor benefits constituted illegal discrimination and ordered the cutoff changed to the 1985 date of the charter. Her ruling entitles the gay and lesbian survivors to back payments from that date, plus interest accrued on payments beginning in 1993. Quebec is the only region not covered by the class action because that province runs its own separate pension plan.
Canada's new Prime Minister, Paul Martin, has also been thinking about the Charter. He told the CBC this week that he was willing to become the nation's first PM ever to invoke the so-called notwithstanding clause, if that's what it took to protect churches from being forced to perform wedding ceremonies for gays and lesbians. Martin, a devout Catholic, admitted that it was unlikely that the Supreme Court of Canada would impose that requirement. Religious freedom is one of the issues already put to the nation's highest court under Martin's now-retired predecessor, Jean Chrétien, in preparation for the introduction of a federal bill to extend full equal marriage rights to same-gender couples. But it's appearing more likely that Martin's administration will further ask the court whether equal federal status of the separate name of civil unions will meet the marriage equality requirements of legal rulings by three top provincial courts. Activists fear that move could further delay federal marriage legislation by as much as another year. It's been suggested that Martin would benefit politically from putting off the court's scheduled April hearing on marriage questions, allowing him to call an election at about that time without that issue in the spotlight.
Massachusetts' top court is also fielding questions about its recent landmark ruling demanding marriage equality for same-gender couples. The Supreme Judicial Court had left the state legislature some time to meet its requirements, and the state Senate voted to ask the court if separate civil unions with the state-level benefits of marriage might suffice. State Assembly members agreed to hold off on their proposals for gay and lesbian unions until the court has responded. The court put out a call for submissions from interested parties.
U.S. President George W. Bush criticized the Massachusetts ruling in an ABC TV interview this week and made his strongest statement of support yet for the federal marriage amendment to constitutionally prohibit legal same-gender marriages, while also seemingly supporting state-level civil unions, a tightrope walk that brought him criticism both from supporters of gay and lesbian equality and from their opponents. Bush told Diane Sawyer,
"If necessary, I'll support a constitutional amendment which would honor marriage between a man and a woman, codify that, and will the position of this administration is that, you know, whatever legal arrangements people want to make, they're allowed to make, so long as it's embraced by the state." Let me tell you that the court, I thought, was a overreached its bounds as a court. It did the job of the legislature. It was a very activist court in making the decision it made, and as you know, I'm a person who believes in judicial restraint as opposed to judicial activism that takes place of the legislative branch.
But Vice President Cheney has spoken out in favor of civil unions. In the 2000 election, you said pretty much it was a state issue.
No, that's right, except unless judicial rulings undermine the sanctity of marriage, in which case we may need a constitutional amendment. I do believe in the sanctity of marriage, but tolerance and belief in marriage aren't mutually exclusive points of view.
The National Gay and Lesbian Task Force labeled Bush's remarks a declaration of war on gay America, and Democratic presidential hopeful Congressmember Dick Gephardt called on the president to end his alliance with bigotry once and for all and speak out against the Republican Party's hostile election year attempt to polarize the election. But the Anti-Gay Family Research Council expressed concern at the president's seeming support of civil unions, viewing them as states redefining of marriage. In fact, the U.S. Constitution leaves the definition of marriage entirely in the power of the individual states. The conservative lobby group Citizen Outreach demanded clarification from the president on issues including whether he would support a constitutional amendment only if a court struck down the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, whether he would support an amendment which denied legal status to civil unions as well as to same-gender marriages, and whether he would accept same-gender marriages if established by a state legislature rather than a court.
Meanwhile, the New Jersey State Assembly this week approved, with minimum required votes, a bill to create a statewide domestic partners registry carrying some significant legal status. Partners' rights would include hospital visitation, medical decision-making, inheritance tax exemption, dependent status for state income tax deductions, spousal benefits for partners of state employees, and a prohibition against discrimination based on having a domestic partner. One controversial point in an hour of heated floor debate was the bill's inclusion of heterosexual couples over age 62, which was also a sticking point as the state Senate Judiciary Committee greenlighted a very similar measure 6-1. If the bill passes the Senate, Governor James McGreevy has indicated he will sign it. A lawsuit seeking equal marriage rights in New Jersey is currently awaiting an appeal.
But last week, the Ohio State House of Representatives passed by a nearly 3-1 margin what's been called a super DOMA, a bill not only to deny legal recognition of same-gender marriages, but to prohibit recognition of all state employees' unmarried partners for the purposes of health insurance and other benefits. Activists believe the language of the bill is such that it could open to challenge any spousal benefit extended to unmarried partners. If it's passed by the state Senate, Governor Bob Taft has indicated he'll sign it.
In the state of Washington, the King County Council this week adopted an equal benefits ordinance requiring employers who contract with the county to extend the same benefits to their unmarried workers' domestic partners as they do to married workers' spouses. The vote was 8-5 to place the requirements on contracts worth at least $25,000.
In Japan, a single vote tipped the balance on the Miyakonojo City Assembly this week as it okayed an ordinance prohibiting discrimination against lesbian gays and people with gender identity disorder. Civil rights protections based on sexual orientation are rare in Japan, with Miyakonojo the first city to adopt them in Miyazaki Prefecture, although at least two cities and other prefectures have adopted them. But the Miyakonojo ordinance is believed to be the first in the nation to protect bisexuals and transgenders as well.
And finally, gay activist and actor Harvey Fierstein found an unusual platform from which to take up the U.S. debate on marriage equality, afloat in New York City's huge annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. Firestein won his seat in the pageant by picking up his fourth Tony Award as the heroine of the hit Broadway incarnation of Hairspray, the role of Edna Turnblatt, created by Divine in Gay John Waters' classic film. To make his point, Firestein declared in advance that he'd appear as Miss Claus and asked in a New York Times op-ed piece if America could accept Santa Claus' resulting gay marriage. This certainly succeeded in creating a buzz on the issue, but the romantic situation was even more complicated. Santa Claus, as always, rode at the end of the parade, accompanied by a female Miss Claus. Not only did this place St. Nick in a love triangle, but Firestein was a kind of triangle in himself. He rode in Santa-less splendor on a separate float, dressed not just as Mrs. Claus, but as Edna Turnblad, dressed as Mrs. Claus.
That's News Wrap for the weekend, December 20th, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm John Beaupre. This is Queer Voices.
It may come as a surprise to fans and readers of And Baby that its publisher, Michelle Darnay, wasn't actually a parent when she began the magazine. Since then, Darnay and her partner have welcomed twin daughters, and their periodical progeny was named one of the 100 greatest gay and lesbian success stories of 2001 by Out Magazine. This Way Out's Steve Pride was tempted to ask the ultimate supermom for milk and cookies, but he was really there to talk with the lesbian media mogul about the ins and outs and the politics of queer parenting.
It's sort of a Cinderella story. Growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, she had 10 brothers and sisters. Right out of high school, she started her career in publishing by loading trucks for a small paper. Today, she lives in New York and is sometimes referred to as the Martha Stewart of the gay and lesbian parenting world. So, who is this Wonder Woman?
Hi, I'm Michelle Darnay, publisher of And Baby magazine.
Michelle, why did you decide to start this magazine?
I had moved to New York, took some time off, wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and Kathleen and myself, my partner, wanted to start a family. I asked one of the girls from my little marketing company if she could research and get me all the information she could on gay and lesbian parenting. At that time, we weren't sure if we wanted to use a donor that we knew, if we wanted to go to a bank. We really were clueless about what to do. When we started to research the market, we realized that there was very little information available. And I was really saddened by that because I'd been working in the mainstream for so long, but I'd been out all my life. I just assumed that we had everything we needed. So here we are, you know, 18 months into research and not finding the information that we need. Thus, And Baby. We launched the magazine in June of 2001 with the idea that we were going to start a family. And what ended up happening was And Baby was so well received. It really became the baby. And we were spending, you know, 14 hours a day at work and working 7 days a week. And it just got crazy. So, of course, the family got put on hold. By then, we knew exactly how we wanted to do it. We were ready, prepared. So me being 38, Kathleen being 33, we really are hoping to have three children. So we decided to get started. And it just so happened that we were really fortunate because we got pregnant immediately, first time out. Now we have two baby girls.
Who is the readership? Is it strictly gay people?
No, actually. The content that you read in And Baby, you will not find anywhere else. I mean, you're not going to find it in parenting. You're not going to find it in child. It's just too risky. They're not going to talk about men breastfeeding. I mean, it's just, you're not going to see those, that kind of stuff in the mainstream. The one thing that I feel that we have in common with the mainstream is children, meaning everyone wants children to have good homes and people that love them. I think that at the end of the day, everybody's sort of striving for that goal. The nice thing about this publication is that it really crosses over. There's a lot of information for the mainstream that they can't find either. And there's a lot of people that are waiting till they're older to have children, a lot of straight couples. So what ends up happening is them getting pregnant immediately just doesn't happen. They a lot of times have to seek outside assistance. So I find that they'll pick up the magazine because we talk about surrogacy, we talk about adoption, we talk about other options than, quote, the typical. Obviously, primary readership is gay and lesbian or want to be parents that are gay and lesbian. We find a lot of people who are thinking of starting a family. So they can pick a band baby and really get a good understanding of sort of what they're up against. Trials and tribulations, and all the wonderful things about having a family as well.
What were your challenges in getting advertisers on board?
It was a big thing to say, you know, if you're working for a gay and lesbian publication, that I have this publication and we have all the spendable income, because guess what? We don't have any kids. We don't have any braces. We don't have any of those things. So now the pitch, you know, for us, of course, is opposite. What we find is that it takes planning. It takes strategy. It takes money. None of us have children by accident. So it's a really planned effort. Depending on what route you go, of course, it can tend to be very expensive. So what I tell the advertising clients is that, you know, here we are, people that are doing, jumping through hoops to start a family and wanting to do things right. You know, so many of us were raised with, oh, you're gay, go to the back of the bus sort of thing. So I think that a lot of the families, when they actually are getting ready to start their process and figure out what's going to be best for their family and their family unit, I think that the amount of thought and process is just, it's incredible what people do to have families.
Times, they are changing, but it's still a long, hard road for gays and lesbians who want to be parents.
That saddens me, because we have millions and millions of children across the country that need homes, that are in the foster care system. And we have millions of gay and lesbian people that want these children. And of course, surrogacy and all these other options, they're very expensive. We really do have to jump through hoops. And I'm hoping that with Ann Baby and what's going on sort of with the whole revolution, is what I call it, that over time, it's not going to be this difficult.
What impact did Rosie O'Donnell have on public awareness and acceptance of gay parenting?
Rosie has a famous face. The more celebrities that come out, the better it is for us. And not even necessarily, take the celebrity part out of the equation. The more people that come forward, the more people who are proud of who they are, who can stand up and say, this is my family, I'm a great mother, I'm a great father, what have you, the better off we're going to be, period. I spend a lot of time educating people. I mean, of course, I'm the publisher of the magazine, but take the magazine out of the equation. I still spend a lot of time educating people. People will ask me and Kat, walking down the street with the girls. I mean, you find yourself explaining just sort of your family dynamic, because people sort of assume, oh, you must have a husband somewhere, or, you know, one of those girls has this husband at home, or whatever. So you do some educating, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
What's the reaction and the feedback you've gotten from the gay community overall? Because it's a very diverse community.
I think that everybody in our community wants to have children. I think that there are people in our community that, you know, could care less. But I think that overall, I think the community as a whole is happy about the fact that it went to this other level. It's a very political statement to have a family. So I think that it's sort of reaching all the different people in our community.
One thing that struck me looking through your magazine is that it takes gay pride for granted.
I get that a lot. People say, you know, you just sort of don't apologize for being gay. I never apologize for being gay. I'm very happy with who I am. You know, I was in a family that loved me, what I always say, in spite of myself, regardless. I have this incredible, incredible mother who knew I was a lesbian before I did. I've always worked and I've always been out. And if anybody had an issue with it, I never really heard about it, because I just kept sort of blowing right by them. And I took that approach with the magazine as well. I'm proud of the fact that we can have families.
What do you think that the top political issues for gay parents are these days?
Well, I mean, obviously, the whole adoption situation. You know, some states allow second parent adoption, some states don't, and sometimes they do, and then they say they don't, and it's just that. I mean, part of where we're in problem with the whole legal side and the political side is that we're having issues that are coming up now that have never been addressed. Like, for example, you're with your partner. Say that you, let's use women, for example. You have this great partner. You think that this is it. You decide you're going to start a family. Okay? One of the parents carries the baby. She is now the biological mother, right? The other parent obviously has to adopt those children in order to be as a legal parent within their family unit. What happens when they split up? Now we've got property separation. We've got children. We've got alimony, all of these issues that really haven't been addressed legally. They've never really had to be addressed legally. You know, so what's happening is the legislation is having a difficult time because there's no written word for how to handle these cases. So these things are being handled sort of in a case-by-case basis. It's crazy. Legally, we haven't caught up to what's going on, or politically, with what's actually happening in the marketplace, so to speak.
And you're sending this out into a world that you're eventually going to send your children out into.
Exactly. Exactly. 5 years from now, when they start kindergarten, I don't want it to be an issue that they have two mommies. You know, I mean, I wish that we didn't have to have this magazine. I do. I wish that we didn't have to. But I'm also glad that we can bring all this information together and that you have resources. There's doctors and attorneys, and there's tons and tons of resources within the magazine. So if you want to start on this endeavor or think about this process, you actually have somewhere to go. I didn't have that. when I started, or when we were thinking about starting a family.
Besides And Baby magazine, Michelle Darnay has plans for a spin-off radio show, a clothing line for kids, and maybe even a television show. Not bad for a working mom. For more information on her magazine, point your internet browser to andbabymag.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Baby, don't say a word. I'm gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird won't sing, I'm gonna buy you a diamond ring. And if that diamond ring is brass, Papa gonna buy you a looking glass. And if that looking glass will break, Papa gonna buy you a chocolate cake. Let's make it.
This is Janice Ian.
I'm B.D. Wong.
I'm Kate Quinn.
This is Judy Shepard.
I'm Armstead Maupin.
This is Dorothy Ellis.
A summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community.
The Supreme Court says we matter and we're valuable.
Being gay is not a crime.
It says intended bridegroom and intended bride. Power intended spouse and intended spouse.
To press forward with this consecration will be to turn our backs on Almighty God.
It's not about me. It's about so many other people at the margins.
Finally, all families in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will have the opportunity to be equal families under the law.
My name is Billy Bean.
This is Margaret Cho.
This is Greg Louganis.
I'm Patricia Nell Warren.
This is Ben White.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
This is Ian McKellen.
I'm Amanda Burst.
I'm Bruce Valanche. And you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. Please do stay tuned.
And finally this week, a word about next week's special program, after we climb aboard the Holiday Express for a bit of seasonal silliness.
Santa, yeah.
2003 was a year that featured war, political intrigue, and a huge victory for the lesbian and gay community. And as always, our LGBT musicians provided a soundtrack. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Join us as we take a look back at our favorite sounds of the year on the 2003 Audiophile Year in Review, coming the last week of December here on This Way Out,
the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Freeman, John Dupre, Graham Underhill, Frensberry, Lex Wagner, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to J.D. Doyle. Holiday Express performed Disco Santa, Bobby McFerrin sang Hush Little Baby, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link to our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. Please visit thiswayout.org to find out how you can get a trio of 2003 year-in-review CDs by supporting This Way Out. For our associate producer, Lucia Chappell, and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Dick Gordon. Thanks for listening on 7THE Hobart, Tasmania, WRUV Burlington, Vermont, KMUD KNUE Garberville, Eureka, California, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We wish you happy holidays as you stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Lilias White performing Silent Night on the album Home for the Holidays. And I could just imagine a drag queen lip-syncing to that and pretending to really belt it out. Now to something completely different, as they say. Here is a song called I Fell in Love with a Dead Boy. And this is from an original motion picture soundtrack for The Event. And after we play this, Jack is going to tell us about it.
I find you with red tears in your eyes. I ask you, what is your name? You offer no reply. Should I call a doctor? For I fear you might be dead. But I just lay down beside you and held your hand. Fulfill me. Now I tell my friends I fell in love with a dead boy. Now I tell my family I wish you could have met him. Australia. Now throw a bottle out to sea. I whisper the secret in the ground. No one's gonna take you away from me. I fell in love with a dead boy. Oh, such a beautiful a beautiful boy. I ask him, are you a boy or a girl? Are you a boy or are you a girl? Are you a boy or a girl?
And that is a song from the soundtrack, The Event, which we talked about a little bit earlier.
That was Anthony and the Johnsons, and Jack hasn't seen a picture of this artist, but I have, and he's real creepy looking.
I'm not surprised.
Imagine Boy George left out in the rain.
That's sort of how he looks in his play, isn't it? Have you seen it? The picture?
Yeah, the picture's from Taboo. Yes. That's really strange looking. I'm not sure I'd want to see that. I don't know.
And I think the reviews were pretty good on that play.
And this was a London play first, but then Rosie O'Donnell got a hold of it, and they ended up having all new music written.
Really?
Uh-huh. I believe Charles Bush was involved with writing some of the music.
Okay.
And she was in Die, Mommy, Die.
Okay, we were stretching here for a little bit because we did talk about this a little bit earlier. We're having trouble connecting with our guest, but Joan is working on that right now, and we will be doing that subject, talking about gay marriage from a person who is involved in it in California. Real interesting today on All Things Considered, they were talking about, there were two polls done about that, and one came out that majority of people were for an amendment, and the other one was majority were against it. And part of it was the way it was worded, whether you word something in the affirmative or word something in the negative. And you may want to check with
that. Was this a radio poll or a website
poll? There was two different polls. One was a CBS Times poll, and I forget the other one. Joan?
Yes, we do have our guest available. As we suspected, there was a little bit of a mix-up with the time. And Glenn is going to introduce this because on the heels of our interview, or I guess at the forefront of our interview, he has some interesting news tidbits to pick up off of gay.com.
That's right. In an open letter released on Friday, nearly 25 Catholic priests said they could no longer remain silent. The Vatican's anti-gay beliefs, calling them vile and toxic. The priests then labeled the Vatican's actions as increasingly violent and abusive, warning that such an archaic stance was starting to alienate the Catholic Church from the modern world. As priests and pastors, we are speaking out to make clear that our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters are all members of God's family, brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and deserving of the same dignity and respect owed any other human being, they wrote. The stand against the Vatican comes at the end of a year of increased Catholic resentment towards the LGBT community. The pinnacle of the controversy was a document on same-sex relationships released last summer. It called for all Catholic politicians to repeal, block, and prevent any laws giving lesbian and gay couples legal rights or equality. The document, authorized by the Pope, told the world's Catholics that same-sex relationships go against the natural moral law. Quote, legal recognition of homosexual unions, or placing them on the same level as marriage, would mean not only the approval of deviant behavior, but would also obscure basic values which belong to the common inheritance of humanity, it added. 2003 also saw the Vatican preach therapy to cure homosexuality and suspend relationships with the Anglican Church over the appointment of a gay bishop. Joan?
Well, we have on the phone Davina Katulski, PhD, who has written a book called Why You Should Give a Damn About Gay Marriage. And Davina, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you, Joan. I want to thank you for inviting me to be a part of this conversation.
And I guess the obvious first question is, why should we give a damn about gay marriage?
Well, as you may or may not know, there are 1,049 federal rights that come with marriage, and at this time, gay and lesbian couples do not have access to those rights. Additionally, each state has several hundreds of rights, and at where we're at today, even if a state like Massachusetts does legalize same-sex marriage, those marriages would only be valid in Massachusetts because of the Defense of Marriage Act, and the Defense of Marriage Act does not allow us to recognize the Equal Protection Clause. And so we've created a second-class citizenship for gay and lesbian people, and any time we create a discriminatory status for one group of people, we're all hurt by that.
In your introduction to your book, you talk about the religious right, or you refer to them as the religious Reich, and it talks about how they keep talking about a homosexual agenda, but then you go on to say that most people, gay or straight, really don't know what those 1,300 plus benefits are to marriage.
That's right. I believe that most Americans are for fairness, equality, and freedom, but they don't understand the distinction between domestic partnerships, civil unions, and civil marriage, and then religious marriage. And so the way things are getting spun now by the religious right, it's looking like gay and lesbian people can simply get a good attorney and create parity, which they cannot. And we're saying that the religious affiliations that want to keep marriage as, or at least perform just religious marriages, not for gay people, should have that option, but that the state should not be discriminating. The state should offer same-sex couples the same rights as other couples. And when most fair-minded Americans know what these rights are and how gay people are being hurt by them and their families are being hurt, I think that more people will come out for marriage equality for same-sex couples.
What are a few of these? Just, you know, kind of give us a couple of them.
Okay, one of the rights is the right, Americans have the right to sponsor a partner into this country. So if you go overseas and you meet somebody and you fall in love, you can bring that person back and sponsor them as an immigrant and they can get citizenship. For gay and lesbian couples, they can't. And so a lot of times we see people traveling overseas, even gays in the military who have to be closeted, and they might meet somebody overseas while they're working over there and fall in love, but then they cannot bring that partner back into the United States. Some of the other rights have to do with Social Security benefits. At this time, had I died yesterday, my partner of 7.5 years at retirement age would not have access to $1,800 a month in Social Security benefits. And as you know, seniors live frequently below the poverty level and are just making it, just barely getting by. And so gay and lesbian seniors do not have access to their partner's Social Security, even if they've been together like Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin for 50 years, they cannot access each other's Social Security. However, a heterosexual couple that have only been together for a year can have access to the Social Security, and even a divorced spouse can have access to Social Security.
I guess we saw that brought to the forefront, too, in the dog mauling case, where
right.
the woman that was killed was actually the primary breadwinner for the family. And because they were a lesbian couple, there were benefits and insurance and a lot of things lost that would not have probably been lost in a heterosexual situation.
Right. When Diane Whipple was killed, her partner, Sharon Smith, was not allowed to sue for wrongful death. That's a right that comes with automatically with marriage. So Sharon, in the year that she should be, you know, have the opportunity to grieve the loss of Diane, had to become an accidental overnight activist and start, a lawsuit to give herself the ability to sue for Diane's wrongful death. Any husband and wife would be able to do that. Similarly, there's something called loss of consortium. And loss of consortium is when a spouse is in an accident, the other spouse can sue for lost wages, companionship, even sexual companionship. And there is a number for that, a dollar number that they can sue for. But if a same-sex couple is in a similar situation, they cannot. So, for example, a couple I know named Jules and Maitreya, one of the partners was in a motorcycle accident where a cab flew through a light and hit her. Well, her partner, her wife, was pregnant at the time with their child, and because the one person was in the hospital, she could not care for her partner who had horrible morning sickness, and she was actually in the hospital for 3 months. And you can imagine someone who's 5 months pregnant and trying to deal with the pregnancy is now out of work because of the pregnancy, because she's having such terrible trouble with the pregnancy. Her partner was not able to be there for her, but they could not sue for loss of consortium. A heterosexual couple would have been able to.
Wow. I guess the other questions I have for you is, how would you respond to those who would say, yeah, but the polls are out there saying that most Americans are against this? I mean, should we even take that into consideration?
Well, I think what's interesting is there's a poll that was done by the New York Times, a Gallup poll that was published in the New York Times in 1968, a year after interracial marriage was legal. And it said that only 20% of Americans supported interracial marriage. A similar poll was done in 1997 and found that only two-thirds of Americans supported interracial marriages. And so I think if we wait for people to be supporting this versus acting because there's an inequality, I think we'll wait forever. It's hard to imagine how long it would have taken for a majority of people to be supportive of interracial marriage had the court not come down in Loving v. Virginia in 1967, said it doesn't matter if the public supports us or not, it is the right and just thing to do. And so, you know, in marriage is a fundamental right, and so we're going to vote, you know, we're going to strike down the ban against interracial marriage. So I think the courts in Massachusetts actually were following the Supreme Court in the Loving v. Virginia case by doing, you know, what was right rather than what is popular. Although in this state, 60% of folks in Massachusetts do support the right of same-sex couples to marry, which is a similar situation in New Jersey at this time. But people don't talk about those polls. They talk about more of the national polls.
Right. Now, when's your book coming out, and how can people get it?
It will be out April 1st of next year, and they can get it through Allison Publications at www.allison.com, and A-L-Y-S-O-N. Also, they could look for it on marriageequalityca.org, www.marriageequalityca.org. And I just encourage folks to get involved with this movement. It's definitely equal rights. It's not a special rights, and it's not a gay rights issue.
Great. Well, I want to thank you so much. We've been talking to Davina Katulski, Ph.D., whose book, Why You Should Give a Damn About Gay Marriage, will be coming out on April 1st. And, Jack, what do we have for the rest of the evening?
Well, before we go into the Queer Music Heritage Christmas Special Part 2, I think J.D. wants to talk about next week's This Way Out.
Yes, This Way Out next week will be a totally half-hour show devoted to a recap of the best music that we featured all year on Audiophile. So there'll be no news wrap, no other segments. It'll all be a half-hour Audiophile show. And you find out which CDs we picked at the best of the year.
And then in the second hour next week, Glenn's going to be doing the best of the stories that were most important to our audience in 2003.
It's 2003. It's, you had to think about that one.
I know. So, well, let's wrap it up for this show and go into the special Christmas.
FM, this is KPFT in Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky, Joan Devlin, and Glenn Holt.
Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Just sing if you're happy.
scratchy, bubbly Christmassy self, Daddy.
I am gay. I'm gay. I'm the gayest everybody here.
Hey, you sure could have fooled me.
Welcome to the Queer Music Heritage Christmas Special. Now, see if you can figure out who this is. Again, welcome to Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and I'm here on Queer Voices on the fourth Monday of every month to bring you an hour devoted to our culture's music. This is my special Christmas show, featuring the music you won't be sick of by now. This is actually part two of my Queer Christmas special, as last week I also brought you an hour of very queer Christmas music. If you have a high-speed internet connection, you can still hear it, and all my past shows at www.queermusicheritage.com. I opened the show with a clip from the TV show All in the Family and followed that with Jingle Bell Rock by none other than K.D. Lang. While she's never released a recording of that song, she sang it on TV in 1987 on Pee Wee Herman's Christmas special. And now for a couple songs that are just plain nice. They are from an album put together by Richard Foltz called A Songwriter's Christmas. In my opinion, it's one of the best gay Christmas albums, and I play selections from it every year. This time you'll hear Laura Wetzler with Ring Bells and Tom McCormick singing Christmas Will Start.
Ring bells, sing songs, blow the trumpet loud and strong, all together to welcome Christmas Day. Sing the old songs, those we've loved for all so long. Trees. When we were young and pine trees seemed so tall, I'm glad we still assemble for the holiday. Like every year, I can recall sleigh bells and horns sound the birth of Christmas morn. Christmas Day.
Before we get to Tom McCormick's song, I want to share with you some comments he gave me about the project.
Richard Foltz had approached me to help produce some of the cuts on his CD, A Songwriter's Christmas. Richard is a wonderful man and friend who every year writes a Christmas song and sends it out, you know, as his Christmas greeting, and wanted to create a CD of his music, and he wanted to bring in a lot of the out music musicians to produce and perform them. I produced three of the tunes, and one of them I sang, called Christmas Will Start. It's a wonderful song about, you know, waiting until the one that you love returns to celebrate Christmas. And it was just a lot of fun working with Richard and creating that track.
Just like a child who's watching for Santa's sleigh,